from KQED.
This is a special statewide broadcast of the California Report. Good evening, I'm Scott Schaefer. In a moment, we'll be going live to Dominican University in San Rafael for the third and probably final debate between the Republican and Democratic candidates for governor, Meg Whitman and Jerry Brown. Tonight's event comes at a pivotal moment in the campaign. It's exactly 3 weeks from Election Day, and with polls showing the race is still very close, both candidates have a lot at stake in this face-off tonight. Now let's go to debate moderator Tom Brokaw at Dominican University.
NBC presents the 2010 California gubernatorial debate, live from Dominican University of California in San Rafael. Now, Tom Brokaw.
Good evening from Dominican University in California in San Rafael, and welcome to the third and final debate of 2010, the race for governor, a crucial election at a crucial time for this state and, for that matter, for the nation. The winner of this race will face daunting issues on the economy and jobs, the budget and pensions, immigration, education, and health care. Tonight, we will get answers to those questions on all these topics and more. From the Democratic candidate, Attorney General Jerry Brown, and the Republican contender, former eBay CEO Meg Whitman. Let's review the rules of engagement now before we begin. Each candidate will have 90 seconds to answer each question. Rebuttals and follow-ups will be allowed at my discretion. They will last for 30 seconds. There's a great deal of ground to cover here tonight, of course. The candidates have agreed to forego opening statements, and a coin toss was held to determine which gets the first question. That will go to Meg Whitman. Jerry Brown, at the conclusion of this hour, will get the last question. To you, Ms. Whitman, and Attorney General Brown, welcome. Nice to have you with us tonight. Let me remind you of something that I know you were familiar with at one point in your lives, but it seems to have been lost in American politics. 50 years ago this January, John F. Kennedy at his inauguration said famously, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." Modern campaigns, and yours is no exception, spend most of their time telling voters what they can do for them. Tonight, I'd like you to begin by looking into the camera and saying to the voters of California, as citizens of this state, this is what you must do for California at this crucial time. Ms. Whitman, you begin, please.
Well, first of all, thank you so much to Dominican University. Thanks to you, Tom. I'm sorry about your ankle, but I am delighted to be here tonight. And I'll start the answer to that question by telling you why I came to California. 30 years ago, my husband and I moved here as newlyweds. My husband wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to be in business. We wanted to raise our family here because everything was possible in California. And I was very lucky. I ended up running one of the great internet success stories and really lived the California dream. I don't think that my story would be possible in really any other country of the world, and maybe not even in any other state. But today, what I see is the California dream is broken. And not everyone has a chance to live their life, to raise their children, to send their kids to public school, to be successful doing what they love. And that's why I'm running for governor of California. I want to bring that California dream alive. And what people are going to have to do is support the next governor in making some very tough trade-offs. We have a government we can no longer afford. We continue to spend more money than we take in. And there's going to be some tough trade-offs. Everyone's going to have to make a sacrifice to get California back on track. But if we do that, I can tell you, we have an incredible opportunity. This is a great state with tremendous people, more compassion, more courage, more innovation than any other state in the union. But we're going to have to pull together. I am a big believer that what we can do together, none of us can do alone. And there's going to have to be some shared sacrifice.
Mr. Brown.
Thank you. I, too, thank the sponsors of this debate and Dominican University for allowing us to come into your homes and to be part of this very historic exchange of ideas. John F. Kennedy did ask Americans, ask not what you can do for yourselves, but what you can do for your country. And I have to tell the people of California, we do have to make some tough decisions. We have to live within our means. We can't point the finger. We can't scapegoat, whether it's government employees or immigrants or neighbors down the street or the opposite political party. We're going to have to rise above the poisonous partisanship and our own comfort zone, our own identities, whether they be ethnic or gender or partisan or religious. And we have to think, we really have to think for the first time as Californians first, as members of these other categories second. We are a great state. We have tremendous potential. And while people on the East Coast say this is some kind of failed state, it's not. This is a state of 38 million people. Last year, the wealth created by the people and the businesses of this state equaled $1.8 trillion. That's more than most of the countries in the world. So this is a wealthy, fabulous place with a great environment. I love California. I've lived here all my life. And I just want to say, I think I can fix it. I've got the know-how and the experience, and that's exactly what I want to do if you give me the chance.
Ms. Whitman, in June of this year, the Pew Organization polled the voters of California. 40% of them said you could cut the state budget by 20% and not affect the services that they've gotten used to. Someone did an analysis of those cuts, and to make that kind of a cut in the state budget, you'd have to give up the prison system, transportation, and welfare. Have the voters of California become utterly unrealistic about the realities of their budget situation as a result of year after year of deficits and crawling to the finish line in the budget process?
I think the voters of California have the right instincts. They know the government isn't run efficiently and effectively. And the first thing we have to do to get this budget back on track is we have to put Californians back to work. For families, the solution is a job. That's the solution for our budget. We've got to put Californians back to work. But then I've identified $15 billion worth of savings that I think, actually, if we achieve them, it will make California stronger, not weaker. We need to shrink the size of government. We need to have fewer people working. We need to fewer people working in the government. We need to use technology to do more with less. Then we have to make two very tough reforms. First is to the public employee pension system. We have a pension system that the taxpayers of California can't afford anymore. It's a $60 to $100 billion unfunded liability. What that means is the taxpayers of California owe more money than they can afford to pay. Then we have to reform welfare. We have become the welfare state. 12% of the population lives here, and we have 32% of the welfare cases. We have the longest time on welfare, and it's not the right thing for our budget, but it's really not the right thing for our communities. And then last, we have got to run the government more efficiently and effectively. The Bay Bridge is a perfect example. From San Francisco to Oakland, the seismic repairs were supposed to cost $1 billion. It cost $4 billion. Over budget, simply not acceptable. And what happened in Sacramento is the parties just blamed each other as opposed to taking accountability for results.
Mr. Brown, have the voters of California become unrealistic about the hard choices that they have to make based on the polling that we've done?
We're all unrealistic when it comes to pain or sacrifice our hard choices. We don't like to face the tough choices. A long time ago, I said government was facing an era of limits, and boy, people didn't like that. They misinterpreted, they denied it, but it's true. We have limits, and we have to recognize them. And when you make choices, you choose one thing over another. But I will say this. With the complexity of this government, I've decided that the budget process has to start not in January and then dawdle along till June and recently till October. I want to start this budget process in November, a few weeks after the election, if I'm elected governor. And I want to do it in Sacramento with all 120 legislators, and then I want to go to Southern California. I want to go to the Central Valley. I want to go to San Diego. I want the people of this state to reflect on what it is their state government is doing. How much of it do they really want? How much does it cost? And how much do they want to pay for it? Now, we are suffering from a gap. And the gap was caused not just by some overspending in Sacramento, which has happened, but also by the Wall Street meltdown, by the Washington inability to regulate the banks and the mortgage scam artists, people that I'm fighting as Attorney General, and we've received a lot of good judgments on that fact. But whatever, here we are. And I think we can return power to the local level where people can judge it more quickly. I think Caltax has said there's $18 billion in possible fraud and abuse. I don't believe it's that high, but we've got to dig into it where we can. And those at the top should cut first. Lead by example, and I'll do that if I'm the next governor. I'll cut the governor's office by 10 to 15%.
Ms. Whitman, let me raise what has become a holy grail in the state, and that's Proposition 13. I was here when it was passed. It, of course, puts limits on property taxes. A lot of people see that as a boulder in the road to reform. Others do see it as a kind of sacred part of the California tax code. Can you go forward and achieve the goals that you have outlined without reforming in some fashion Proposition 13, which has been in effect in the state now for almost 40 years?
Proposition 13 is absolutely essential to the future of California, and I want to defend Proposition 13. What Proposition 13 does is keep a lid on property taxes. I was in Diamond Bar not too long ago in Southern California and was in the home of an older woman named Marie. She was able to stay in her home even after her husband had died 2 years ago because her property taxes were low. If those property taxes had escalated without Proposition 13, her property taxes would have been $6,000 more per year. So one of the reasons I'm running for governor of California is to defend Proposition 13. The really only sustainable way to increase tax revenues is create more jobs. The more jobs there are, the more companies are paying taxes, the more individuals are paying taxes. And the only way we're going to do that is we have to reduce taxes, we have to decrease streamline regulation, which is strangling businesses of all sizes, and then we have to compete for jobs. It's not okay that many big companies are leaving California for neighboring states like Arizona or Colorado or Utah. For example, the headquarters of DaVita, a healthcare services company in Los Angeles, just announced they were moving their headquarters to Denver, Colorado. And the reason is it's simpler and easier to do business in neighboring states. So we've got to compete for those jobs by having competitive tax rates, by being a help to small business and to big business, as opposed to putting a big red stop sign in their way and saying, you know what, doing business in California, it's just going to be harder than it is in neighboring states.
Mr. Brown, is Proposition 13 sacrosanct even for commercial properties?
Well, look, there's no sacred cows over the long term. We have to look at things. But I support the implementation of Proposition 13. I once opposed it, and then I made it work. As a matter of fact, Howard Jarvis, the author of Proposition 13, actually voted for me and did a campaign commercial because he said even while he created 13, I was the one that made it work. And we made it work because I'd built up a $5 billion surplus, which didn't exist when I became governor. We were looking at a recession, and as we came out of that, I held down spending. By the way, there's a couple of myths in Proposition 13. The actual business side of the role and the homeowners are contributing about the same in taxes, and their assessed values have grown. So we've got to find ways to live within our means. We've got to make tough decisions. We've got to return the authority to local level. A lot of the problem of 13 is that because the state provided bailout and money, the state took over more and more power, micromanaging the schools, sending more and more controls down to cities and counties and special districts. I would do my utmost to return authority and decision-making to local communities where it's closer to the people. And then finally, one thing I wouldn't do to compound our budget deficit and our tax unfairness, I wouldn't totally eliminate the capital gains tax, which my opponent Meg Whitman wants to do. That capital gains tax benefits mostly millionaires and billionaires and would add $5 to $10 billion to our budget deficit, and a lot of that money would have to come from public schools. And I just don't believe that's right.
Ms. Whitman, so, I think this is the first opportunity for a rebuttal tonight.
Right, thank you. So Jerry Brown's just wrong about this. The capital gains tax, the tax that he likes so much, is a tax on jobs, it's a tax on job creators, and it's a tax on investment. And we compete with other states. Three other states, Washington, Texas, and Nevada, have no capital gains tax. If we eliminate this capital gains tax, what you'll see is more jobs, more businesses, more tax revenues, so we can invest in the things that we really want to invest in. We are not competitive with neighboring states, and to the recovery effort that I have planned, tax cuts are a big part of it.
And you have 30 seconds for a follow-up.
Well, first of all, 82% of the benefit of this tax break will go to people making $500,000 a year, and there's not one guarantee they'll spend that money in California. And, Ms. Whitman, I'd like to ask you, how much money will you save if this tax break were in effect this year or last year?
So, you know what? I'm an investor, and investors will benefit from this, but so will job creators. And I was a job creator. And you know what? We have got to get someone in office who knows what the conditions are for small businesses to grow and thrive. My track record is creating jobs. My business is creating jobs. Your business is politics. You've been doing this for 40 years. And you have been part of a war of the war on jobs in this state for 40 years. You've increased regulations, you've increased taxes, and you've made it more difficult for small businesses to grow and thrive here.
By the way, I have to say, those last three statements are demonstrably false, pointed out by our hometown newspaper, the San Jose Mercury, and my hometown newspaper, the Oakland Tribune. Taxes went down when I was governor, $4 billion. Jobs were $4.9 million. And by the way, regulations, I haven't been in state government in Sacramento was governor for 28 years. There have been three Republicans and one governor. So if there are more regulations, which there are, you can call those people to account.
Ms. Brown, let me move on to another subject if I can.
Tom, I got to answer that if it's all right.
That's okay.
So you know what you just heard is a classic politician answer. It's a half answer and therefore a dishonest answer. Jerry Brown talks about having created all these jobs when he was governor, but the fact is unemployment nearly doubled to what was then a record 11%. There were 400,000 more Californians without a job at the end of his term than at the beginning of the term. And that's the kind of half answer that's the reason that people don't trust politicians. And spending went up by 120% during your and by the way, deficit went from a $6 billion surplus to a $1 billion budget deficit. So that's the record, and you need to be accountable for that record.
Okay, I got to say, just 2 points, because this, by talking about half answers, your story on pensions is a big half answer, but I'll get to that later. Look, we have something called a business cycle, and I would presume you as a businesswoman know all about the business cycle. We get booms and we get busts. And when we're in the recessionary period, unemployment goes up. But we've come back. 7 times since World War II, we've been in recession, and we always come back. We did create new jobs. Yes, we're in a recession. And 2 years later, California was booming again, as we will, if we make the tough decisions and live within our means.
This is an opportunity for me to engage in something called a fact check. And in fact, I looked up the numbers at the end of Mr. Brown's term as governor of California. It was in the middle of the Ronald Reagan recession. And there were 4 Republican states, Illinois, Ohio, and Michigan, and or Indiana, and Tennessee, all had Republican governors and higher unemployment rates at that time because of the recession, just so you have some perspective on that. But, Mr. Brown, let me get back to you on the budget. We've just been through a torturous process here in the state of California. It took 100 days for the legislature and the governor to reach what everyone agrees is a budget of smoke and mirrors. They say that they balance the budget in some fashion, but the numbers simply don't hold up. You have said that the process is the plan. You have outlined something very similar to what they just went through here to try to get to a balanced budget. So hasn't the experience of the last 100 days in Sacramento undermined any authenticity to the plan that you want to put forward to the voters of California?
Tom, that's a very good question. I'll tell you why it's different. First of all, I don't have to learn on the job. I've done 8 budgets. 4 of them were absolutely on time, and a couple were a few days late. All right? But I've done this before. Now, what my plan is not to have the governor present a budget in January, then everybody sits around until June, and then they get serious around August and September. I'm talking about 2 weeks after this election. I believe the next governor should call all 120 legislators into the room, into the wherever you can get it big enough, and start going over this budget in detail. Then I want to bring in the special interest groups, and I want to work on a budget analysis and workout plan in November, December, and January. I want to take it on the road. I want to go to Los Angeles and San Diego. You said earlier the people think, have certain ideas about the budget, may or may not be true. I think we have to articulate in a very clear way what is California government. What do we want in our schools, in our prisons, in our highways, in our waterworks? And I think that intensive conversation, not the 4,000 bills, not the fundraising, not all the gimmicks and perks that we see in Sacramento. That's status quo. I want something entirely different, and I also want to start at the top. I want to see the governor cut 10 to 15% out of his budget, and then the legislature. And then I have a number of other cuts that, if we have the time, I'll outline them.
Ms. Whitman, taking a look at the budget that was just passed, in your first 100 days, what alterations would you like to make in the budget that you're about to be handed if you are elected governor of the state of California?
Well, the next governor has to have a plan, and you're exactly right. Attorney General Brown said the process is the plan. If you like the process that we have in Sacramento, if you think this is working for Californians, then you should elect Jerry Brown, because if he goes to Sacramento, it will be the same old, same old. What I bring is an entirely fresh approach and a very detailed plan that we'll engage the legislature with. And by the way, you know, when Governor Brown says he's going to start by cutting 10 to 15% of the governor's budget, do you know how much the governor's budget is?
Yeah, it's a lot bigger than when I was there.
No.
But if you start from the
governor's,
top and sacrifice.
The governor's office budget is $18 million. If he cuts 15% out of the budget, he's going to save $2.7 million, which is less than 1/100 of 1% of the $20 billion budget deficit that we face. If that is your plan for fixing the budget, we have really big problems ahead of us. I've got a very detailed plan. I think that's part of leadership. You have to say what you think is the plan to get Californians back on track. And then we've got to engage the legislature. We've got to make sure that you have the right appointments. But the governor has got to have a plan and a way forward. If you don't know which way you're going, any road will take you there. And that is the problem with the dysfunctional government that we have in California today. We need a fresh approach, a different approach. And I've got 30 years of experience in balancing budgets, in using technology. You know what's great about Silicon Valley? When we have a problem we can't solve, we figure out how to go after it. You go around it. You go over underneath it. You figure it out using technology. In Sacramento, they hunker down and just do the same thing over and over again, and it's not going to work in the future.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Whitman. And Mr. Brown, let me move on to another subject.
Well, can I just respond? I know what the budget of the governor is. It was a fraction of what it is today when I was governor. But here's the point. I want those in power who are at the top to lead by example. I want to see them feel some of the pain and some of the sacrifice. If you don't lead from the top, it's very hard to ask those below you to do things. By the way, she doesn't have a detailed plan. She said 14 billion in cuts, doesn't say what they are. Said 40,000 people, doesn't say who or where or what departments. And by the way, you got to get the legislature on board or nothing happens.
Ms. Brown, let me let me come to you with the 100,000-pound gorilla in the room in California, and that's public pension programs. California is now being compared to Greece in a lot of sectors because of the amount of money that they're paying for public pensions. You have 12,000 state employees who are making more than $100,000 a year in retirement, 3,000 teachers who are earning more than $100,000 in retirement. Any reform of the pension program, what is the role of current pensioners? Should they be required to start cutting back on the amount of money that they feel obligated to receive?
Okay. Very interesting issue, the pension reform. And I have a very detailed pension reform plan that you can go to jerrybrown.org and see it. Everyone has got to face facts. The pensions are only paid by the stock market, by the employer, and by the employee. You asked about existing employees. They can contribute more to their pension. You can increase the amount of money contributing, and that is the quickest way to inject money into the pensions. The problem is that our pension systems have been telling the politicians that you can keep expanding it, and it expanded quite a lot. When I left the governorship in 82, I put in the Budget Act, get a two-tier pension system as soon as possible. They ignored that. So we need a two-tier pension system. We have to bargain this collectively, and you sit down with the labor groups, as Arnold has. He's already gotten some significant concessions. There's more coming. It's all based on actuarial data. What will the stock market give us? What can we expect? And therefore, what is made up by either the employer or the employee? If the employees don't kick in, then the employer will either have to lay people off or reduce wages in order to pay it. And I think a knowledgeable governor can get the kind of pension compromises that the actuarial numbers require. And I pledge here tonight I will do precisely that.
Does that mean, in your judgment, Ms. Whitman, that those who are receiving these pensions now are taken off the table?
The existing pensioners, we can't touch. They struck a deal. They are retired. They need to have what they have earned. But, you know, you got to listen to what Jerry Brand says. It's a little bit do as I say, not as I do. When you look at Oakland, when he was mayor, the highest paid city manager in practically the country before Bell was his city manager. There were 1,100 employees who make over $100,000, and the number of employees who made $200,000 had gone up by 740%. So we have got to take this on. And here's the problem with the existing pension system. If you're a rank-and-file civil servant today, you can retire at 55 years old with much of your salary and much of your health care benefits till the day you die. I bet virtually no one in the audience tonight has anywhere near that kind of deal. And that pension, that lavish pension benefit, is squeezing out other things we care about. You know, fees have gone up at the University of California by 32% and at CSU. And the reason is that the pensions have gotten so big for all the faculty and staff that it's squeezing out the students. If we do not resolve this pension issue, it is going to cause California to run out of money. Just to give you some perspective, in 2000, we spent about $300 million a year supporting the public pensions. Today, it's $3.9 billion. And new people, new employees have got to come in under a different deal, a 401k-style program for rank and file. For civil servants, for those that carry guns and defend our people every single day, I think they need to stay on a defined benefit program. But the rank and file deal has got to be entirely different, because we can't afford $3.9 billion every year on its way to $4.5 or even $6 billion.
Ms. Whitman, let me follow up with another question, if I may. I was looking at the retirement program in the city of Los Angeles, where they have 31 fire and police officers primarily who have retired on pensions of from $265,000 down to $150,000. By the way, a four-star American Army general retires at a number lower than that, at around $149,000. The city of Los Angeles, within 4 years, will be on the hook for $2 billion in pension programs. That cost will come to Sacramento at some point. Should there be a state law as well that oversees municipalities and county governments and the pension programs that they have?
Well, here's where the governor needs to exercise true leadership, because you're right, a third of the city of Los Angeles budget could go to support the pension benefits. As I said earlier, we've got a $60 to $100 billion unfunded pension liability at the state. And what the governor negotiates with the unions sets the table for the rest of the unions in California. And here is a big difference between me and Jerry Brown. Jerry Brown is beholden to these public employee unions. They have paid for his entire campaign. They are paying for all the independent expenditures that are going to attack ads against me. And I am spending my own money in this race, but it gives me the independence to go to Sacramento. I will not owe anything to anybody except for the voters of California, and I'll have the independence to take on this very serious problem. Because we've got to find a solution that's fair to government workers, but also fair to the hardworking taxpayers of California. And I don't think anyone thinks it's fair for people to retire at $250,000 or $300,000 a year when a four-star general retires at a fraction of that.
Right. And Ms. Whitman, I was just asking you. We're doing pretty well on time. We just have to keep track of the lights down there that'll kind of regulate where we are. Mr. Brown, you get a chance to respond.
First of all, just go to the Internet, look at the Oakland Tribune, where some of the comments she made about what I did or didn't do in Oakland are refuted, as they endorse me and make the point that she distorts the facts. By the way, the woman I appointed, Deborah Edgerly, actually got a lower salary than the mayor that was there before, who was appointed by the previous mayor, who happened to fire. By the way, there's one unexplained elephant in the room here. Ms. Whitman says she's going to exempt fire and police from her pension reform, and they're 25% of the entire pension cost. I say everyone has got to sacrifice whatever union they're in or whatever service, and we have to make it fair to the workers, fair to the taxpayers, and actuarially sound, and I will do that.
Well, let me answer that, if you wouldn't mind. I did not exempt public safety from pension reform. We have to take the age from 50 years old to 55 for retirement. Vesting periods have to extend. The public safety individuals will have to contribute to more to their requirement. But I do think public safety officials have earned a defined benefit program. So I'm not exempting the public safety part of this at all. And one of the biggest levers the governor has is the number of people who work for the state. And that number has increased by 33,000 over just the past 5 years, when the revenues of the state were about where they are today. We have a government we can no longer afford. We have to shrink the size of government to make California stronger to get us back on track.
Mr. Brown, you did attempt to reach out to the police union. The telephone message was left on. It's now a notorious part of this campaign, in which somebody in your campaign referred to Ms. Whitman as a whore. A campaign spokesman then described that as salty language and apologized after a fashion. We've heard no outrage from you about the use of that kind of language, which to many women is the same as calling an African-American the N-word. Have you been in charge of the investigation of your campaign to find out who was responsible for using that phrase?
I don't agree with that comparison, number one. Number two, this is a five-week-old private conversation picked up on a cell phone with a garbled transmission, very hard to detect who it is. This is not well, I don't want to get into the term and how it's used, but I will say the campaign apologized promptly, and I affirm that apology tonight.
You're repeating it to Ms. Whitman?
Yes, I am. I do. It's unfortunate. I'm sorry it happened. I apologize, Ms. Whitman.
So, Jerry, it's not just me. It's the people of California who deserve better than slurs and personal attacks. That's not what California is about. It is not our better selves. And I think people know I think every Californian, and especially women, know exactly what's going on here. And that is a deeply offensive term to women.
Can I just interject? Have you chastised your chairman, Pete Wilson, who called the Congress whores to the public sector unions?
You know better than that, Jerry. That's a completely different thing. The fact that you are defending your campaign, the fact that you are defending your campaign for a slur and, you know, a personal attack on me, I think it's not befitting of California. It's not befitting of the office that you're running for.
It's unfortunate. Private conversation. I'm not even sure it's legal, because you have to get the consent of all the parties, and there's lots of people talking. So, again, Ms. Whitman, I'm sorry it happened. That does not represent anything other than things that happen in a campaign. But the issue there, of course, is pension reform and the fact you got the endorsement of that union. I didn't, because they said I'd be too tough on unions and public employee pensions. And I'll take that.
So that's actually...
Could I ask the audience, please? We have a lot of things that we have to cover here, and we'd like you not to be quite as demonstrative as you are. I know it's sometimes hard to contain yourselves.
Tom,
on both sides.
I got that endorsement because that union knows that I will be tough on crime. And Jerry Brown has a 40-year record of being soft on crime. He appointed judges who were recalled by the voters, Rose Byrd being the very best example, who was simply not fit to be a judge. He is against the death penalty. That union knew exactly where I stood on pensions because I put out a detailed plan in March of this year. That decision was made in late summer. They said that I will be a better defender of the death penalty, of three strikes and you're out, that I will be the friend of law enforcement, and that's why I got that endorsement.
Well, very briefly, I've received the endorsement of the California Police Chiefs, the largest organization of the management, the Police Chiefs of California, also PORAC and several deputy sheriff's organizations throughout the state, and also Sheriff Lee Baca. They know I'm tough on crime, tough on three strikes, and yes, I've defended the death penalty as Attorney General hundreds of times, probably more than anyone else in this state or perhaps even the country.
Ms. Whitman, let me now move to another subject, if I can. The contest between AB 32 and Proposition 23. AB 32 would roll back carbon levels to the 1990 levels by 2020. It is supported by Governor Schwarzenegger and by former Secretary of the Treasury, former Secretary of State George Shultz, one of the most distinguished Californians. You at first said it was a job killer. Then you said you would suspend it for a year and examine it. Are you saying that George Shultz is wrong when he claims that Proposition 23 will kill a bill that will actually create green jobs for the state of California?
Well, let me tell you where I stand on all of this. So first of all, AB 32 was the law that was signed into existence in 2006. And the notion was, could we lead the environmental movement in the United States, stimulate green jobs? And that was the plan. However, today we have a 12.4% unemployment rate. And here's what people really need to understand, is that today only 3% of our jobs are green jobs and 97% of jobs are in the other part of the economy. And AB 32 is going to do real damage to the 97% of the jobs in the rest of the economy. It's not fair to the employees in manufacturing, trucking, packaging, all the other industries to drive those jobs out of state. So I call for a one-year moratorium on AB 32, which, by the way, was built into that law. There is a provision to freeze it and then fix it. That's what I want to do. I want to freeze the implementation for a year and fix it to see if we can't nurture green jobs, but at the same time not drive 97% of the other economy out of this state. So that's my plan. With regard to Prop 23, that would have effectively eliminated AB 32. I said I didn't support that because I thought a one-year moratorium on the implementation was a better way to go. So that's where I stand on all of that. We can be green and smart, but we cannot jeopardize the unemployment, the jobs of people who are working so hard and barely making it today, because we have 2.3 million Californians who wake up without a job, and that has to be our first priority to keep jobs in California and to keep people employed.
Mr. Brown, what's wrong with the one-year moratorium on AB 32?
I'll tell you what's wrong. It's trying to turn the clock back. It's stop and start. It creates regulatory uncertainty. The California Air Resources Board has just adopted as a goal for California a requirement that one-third of our electricity use be from renewable energy. I have a plan that meets that goal, 20,000 megawatts by 2020. When you stop that requirement, as she's advocating, you create uncertainty. You create doubt for investors. Secondly, another part of AB 32 is the low-carbon fuel standard. That incentivizes biofuels and other substitutes for oil. And that we don't want to pull that incentive back. By the way, the people who are crying are two oil companies in Texas and a big conglomerate, a petrochemical conglomerate from the Midwest. They're putting up all the money. Yeah, they don't want to deal with it because, and one of them said, my God, they're going to use less oil in California. You bet. We're going to use more California sun and more California wind, and we'll get it done.
Let me answer that for just a second, because he didn't answer the question that you asked, which is, what is he going to do about the 97% of the jobs that are going to be hurt by AB 32? There was a provision in this law which was such the right provision. In times of economic duress, when we have so many of our fellow citizens who are without a job, I was in Lancaster, California the other day. A woman came up to me in tears saying that her husband had just lost his job. They were not sure they were going to be able to hang on to their house. He's a trucker. Truckers are going to be hurt by this. So what's wrong with taking a pause? What's wrong with being smart and green and protecting the 97% of the employees who are very vulnerable to just a blind implementation of this bill?
There's no credible study that says 90% of the rest of the economy is going to be hurt by this. I think that's silly. There was a phony economic study that came out of Sacramento State. It's been thoroughly debunked. I mean, yes, the oil companies are screaming, but let me tell you, if you put thousands of people to work retrofitting buildings so they don't burn as much energy, that will put people to work here. It'll save money to consumers. And when I was governor, I adopted those fuel efficiency standards. And over the last 30 years, it saved Californians $50 billion, and it's created 1 million jobs. I want to do that again.
I want to move to another area if we can now. Mr. Brown, what has been the role of the teachers union in the state of education in California currently?
What the role is a very important role, since they represent, through free elections, hundreds of thousands of teachers in California classrooms. And they're a very strong advocate for more money for schools. And that's very important, particularly when you have people like Meg Whitman coming around wanting to cut the capital gains tax and put a $5 billion hole, which a certain amount of that will certainly come from schools. But the teachers are a powerful union. Arnold Schwarzenegger learned that. And I say you don't go to war with all the major elements. She's raised $30 million from the people who will benefit from her capital gains tax. Yes, I'm getting support from many unions as well as business. You have to be tough. When I was governor, I vetoed the pay raises of all the state employees. Not once, but twice. I was the one who said, we better have a two-tier pension system 28 years ago. I'm independent. At this stage of my life, I feel I've got the what it takes to do the right thing, to work with people, but to stand up when they resist things that we really need for California.
Well, I think Jerry Brown needs to get out and campaign more, because every campaign stop I have, which is two or three or four every single week, every day I hear a story about someone who is in jeopardy of losing their job because of AB 32. So I promise you we have to protect the every single job. I want to fight for every job in California. But let me turn to the California Teachers Association. We have a mess on our hands in our K-12 public education system. We are now rated almost at the bottom of all 50 states. And you know who is part of the problem, not part of the solution? The bosses of the California Teachers Association. We have got to fundamentally change how we do things. We've got to have more charter schools. We have to pay the better teachers more. We've got to grade every single public school. And the teachers union fight change every step of the way. You know, there's a parent-to-teacher association. There's a California Teachers Association. There's no kid association. And I want to defend the children. I want to have the very best public school system in America. And we're going to have to make radical changes.
Ms. Whitman, this brings me to something else. It's well known that you're spending $120 million, at least of your own fortune, on this campaign. It's money that you earned, and you have absolutely a legal right to spend it in this campaign. But I think a lot of people wonder, if you were so interested in the state of California, why you didn't vote all those years or get involved in state commissions or in other parts of public life. Is there something about how you have used your fortune for the good of California and other causes that we don't know that you would like to share with us tonight?
Well, let me talk about voting, because I have a lot to say on that. And I am not proud of my voting record. It was wrong, and I take full accountability and full responsibility for it. And I apologize to the people of California. And you're right to look at that. Every candidate is a package of strengths and weaknesses, but I think I have a lot to offer California. And the reason that I have invested my own money in this is because I think we can make California much stronger. I think we can revive the California dream for every single Californian. But I'm up against some pretty big entrenched interests. The public employee unions have poured money into this campaign. Over the last 4 or 5 years in California, they've poured $300 million to control politics in Sacramento. And that expenditure of my own money allows me, as I said, to be independent, to go to Sacramento with no strings attached. And if Jerry Brown gets to be governor of this state, there will be a meeting. He talks about bringing people together. There will be a meeting of all the union bosses who are there to collect the IOUs for them having funded Jerry Brown's entire campaign. And so that ability to invest my own money does allow me independence. And yes, of course, Griff and I have a foundation, a family foundation that supports higher education and health care. But my focus right now is turning the state of California around. I bring tremendous expertise from the private sector. I know how to balance budgets. I bring common sense approach from the real world. And this was always supposed to be a citizen democracy, that you would be anchored in the real world, having faced challenges from what the government. And that's what I bring to this race.
Okay. First of all, my entire campaign has been supported by many businesses and many individuals. In fact, we've raised $2 million on the Internet alone. In addition, Ms. Whitman, in addition to her $121 million, she's raised $30 million from the kind of corporate executives that will benefit directly from her key economic plank, which is not to invest in schools, but to take money from schools and invest in her rich campaign contributors. I mean, that is a fact. I think people ought to take that into account. Secondly, I have stood up to teachers' unions. As a matter of fact, when I ran for Attorney General, the California Teachers Association supported my opponent in the primary. As mayor of Oakland, I created two charter schools, one the Oakland School for the Arts and one the Oakland Military Institute. They're both doing quite well. As a matter of fact, my family foundation put in $1.1 million in these charter schools because they needed the money. And I've learned a lot about how schools work, and I really appreciate charter schools, but I also appreciate the fact that 95% of the kids go to regular schools, and that's where we got to put our attention, not by changing the numerical grade, which we have, to a letter grade, but by recruiting the best teachers we can, taking the control from Sacramento, moving it down to the districts and the schools and the teachers, letting the people closest to the students have the power and authority to make the tough teaching decisions.
Mr. Brown just said something that he knows is not true. I have never said I want to cut spending on education. I want to continue to invest in education. I do have a different plan on how we spend the money that we spend every year. Of all the money we spend, $70 billion, only 60 cents of it, 60 cents of every dollar goes to the classroom, 40% goes to the bureaucracy. We are starving the students to force feed the bureaucracy, and that's why the next governor cannot be beholden to the California Teachers Association, because they want to protect that bureaucracy. And the number two contributor to Jerry Brown's independent expenditures attacking me is the California Teachers Association.
Let me move on to, if I can, because we're beginning to count down here on the clock. Let me go back to immigration. You had a whole debate on that, but there were a couple of unresolved questions. Ms. Whitman, you said that businesses and households ought to be held accountable for employing undocumented workers, as they're called in California. At the same time, you said that businesses, three strikes and you're out, you lose your business license. And then you discovered that you had an undocumented worker with apparently were very good documents that she had and worked for you for 9 years. If you couldn't find someone in your home was undocumented or illegal, how do you expect businesses to be able to do that?
So we went through an employment agency. We looked at three forms of identification. Our housekeeper falsified those documents and came to admit it 9 years later. It broke my heart, but I had to fire her. I had to let her go. But this is why we need a very good e-verify system that allows a business of every size to look at the documentation and know whether it is real or not. But we have to hold employers accountable for hiring only documented workers. Illegal immigration is a huge challenge in California. Estimates are that $6 to $7 billion of the budget goes to services for illegal immigrants. And we have got to get our arms around this challenge. So what I want to do is secure the border. The Border Patrol agents need more resources, more Border Patrol, more infrared and motion detector technology. Hold employers accountable, eliminate sanctuary cities, and finally, we have to have a temporary guest worker program in California that allows people to be here on a temporary basis and work in all kinds of different industries, whether it's agriculture or hospitality. But I've been very clear from the beginning that I didn't think the Arizona law was right for California. It was divisive. It's going to be caught up in the courts. And I've got a better plan. But we have to solve this problem. It is one of the major challenges facing the United States and facing California. And I think I've got a great plan to do it.
Mr. Brown, you're the chief law enforcement officer of the state of California. Why should not businesses be held responsible for the hiring of undocumented workers and pay a penalty if they continue to do that?
Well, businesses should, but this is a federal government responsibility under our Constitution. And almost every police chief I know does not want to be in the business of raiding businesses. That's what the Immigration Service is for. And I actually, as Attorney General, have signed agreements with the federal government so that those illegal immigrants who are arrested, that their fingerprints are sent back to Washington through my office, and if they're illegal, they're made subject to deportation. But wait a minute. The biggest problem here is we have millions of people that are here illegally in the country and in California. They're in the shadows. What are we going to do about it? I mean, is she going to deport them, or are we just going to leave them there? We need a comprehensive immigration reform at the federal level. I strongly support that. And without a path to citizenship, you have no way to deal with the people that are here, that have maybe been here 10 years, that have kids going to our schools, and that have not broken laws. I think we need to think about this very carefully, not just from a political point of view, but from a human point of view. These are real people. These are mothers and dads and kids, and they have this fear, just the fear that her housekeeper had. And by the way, I mean, well, I don't even want to get into that story. I think it's a kind of a sorry tale there. After working for 9 years, she didn't even get her a lawyer. At least I could tell you that could be done. But look, the other thing I wanted to say is about the temporary workers for the farmers. That sounds like the old Bracero program. What the farmers want and what the people want is temporary workers who, if they do their employer, they can actually get a path to citizenship. She says no to that, and that's basically treating people from Mexico as semi-serfs. Just bring them in, work them, and send them back. I don't think that's human. I don't think it's right.
Let me please. Let me move on to another dimension of the whole issue of the relationship between California and Mexico. Mexico is in a state of near anarchy because of drug violence, and a lot of the blame is always focused only on Mexico. But the fact is that drug violence is a result of the enormous purchasing power of drugs in states, especially like California. But I've heard neither one of you talk at all about cracking down on illegal drug consumption in California, which would go a long way toward helping Mexico, our southern neighbor, do something about drug cartel violence. You're the chief law enforcement officer of the state. That has been not a high priority so far as I can tell.
No, Tom, I have to differ with you on that. As part of my department, the Department of Justice, we have the Bureau of Narcotic Enforcement. And we've had several takedowns of cartel-inspired drug operations, prison-connected drug operations in Salinas, in Atwater, in Stockton, in the Imperial Valley. And I've been there myself often to see it. It is tough. It is very dangerous. The cartels that are murdering people below our border are beginning to infiltrate. Not a lot, but the specter is there. And yes, we have gang task forces called the GSET forces. The legislature cut $5 billion out of that. I found other funds to restore most of it. I feel very strongly that this drug operation connected to the prisons, to Mexico, and gangs in our own cities is a very high priority. And as Attorney General, I've made it a high priority of mine.
Ms. Whitman, let me give you a different spin on all that. You're opposed to the proposition that would legalize marijuana in California. What would happen if tomorrow marijuana were legalized, licensed, and controlled by the state? Because it's no secret, in this state and across the country, people can get it wherever and whenever they want to.
So I am firmly opposed to Proposition 19, which is the legalization of marijuana. I think this is not the right thing for our young people. It's not the right thing for our community of citizens of California. But don't ask me. Ask law enforcement. Every single law enforcement official in this entire state is against Proposition 19. And I'll make one other comment. Jerry Brown says that he is tough on drugs and drug crime, but the Narcotics Officers Association of California looked at my record, they examined his record, and they have chosen to endorse me because they know I will back up public safety in California. And this is one of the biggest differences between me and the Attorney General, is our point of view on law enforcement. As I said, Jerry Brown has been soft on crime for 40 years. He has been against the death penalty. He has appointed judges, as I mentioned, Rose Byrd, who fought against all 64 cases of capital punishment that came her way. Ultimately, she was recalled by the voters of California because they didn't like her stance. So I think you have to look at the California Peace Officers Association, who endorsed me, the cops of the Police Protective League of Los Angeles. There's no more frontline police organization than the frontline cops in Los Angeles, and they know I'm going to back them up and be tough on crime and fight drugs in California.
Let me ask you about another proposition that's been getting a lot of attention in California, Proposition 8. Which would ban gay marriages. It's now in the federal court system. How important is that to California and to you personally on a scale of 1 to 10?
Well, I am running for governor of California because we need to do three things. We need to first and foremost jumpstart our economy and get Californians back to work. We've got to cut wasteful government spending, and our K-12 education system is a big mess, and we have to turn it around because we are denying children a chance at a great education. Yep. But Prop 8, personally, I was opposed to Prop 8. I think that term marriage needs to be between a man and a woman. But I was in favor of the very progressive civil union laws that we have in California. But I think the question is, what is the obligation of the Attorney General to defend Prop 8, which is now part of the Constitution of the United States, so it can have its day in court, in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court? And I think the Chief Law Enforcement Officer, the AG, needs to defend that lawsuit, regardless of what your view is on gay marriage. 52% of the people voted for that constitutional amendment, and they need to have their day in court. It needs to go through the appeals process. And thus far, Jerry Brown has refused to defend that. And I think it's really dangerous, because you can't have a governor or an attorney general who makes a decision what part of the Constitution they're going to defend and what part of the Constitution they're not going to defend. I don't think that's the judgment call we want being made. We've got to have the governor and the attorney general who would defend the Constitution of the state of California.
Mr. Brown.
Look, I'm following the precedent that prior Attorney General followed when he refused to defend a discriminatory initiative. And because I believe that the 14th Amendment, which I swear I take an oath to uphold, bans this kind of discrimination against same-sex marriage, I am not entering the court. And I'm not going to appeal it, because it can be appealed by the parties, and that will be there. But when something is so fundamentally wrong as to find, after a long trial, we hear testimony from the pro and the con, and the judge said, this violates the 14th Amendment, I'm not going to be the one to take that up. And I just want to add one more thing on the cops. I've got the police chiefs in my backing me, because they know I'm tough on crime.
I think he said he's got the police chiefs in his back pocket.
No. Sometimes, unaccustomed as I am to politics, I stumble in one of my phrases. I have their backing. Not like some of the ones who are backing you, not because of crime, but because they know you're not going to be as tough. In fact, one of the endorsing police unions said Brown is going to be too tough on unions, and that's one of the reasons why we're supporting Meg Whitman. He put out a press release to that effect. So I think, and by the way, all this crime stuff, I've been a very tough attorney general. I supported the three strikes. And more than that, I want to support some reform, because since I left the governorship, they built 22 prisons, and those things themselves have been adding to the problem. We need criminal justice reform, we need reentry, and we also need to be tough on crime.
All right. Let me thank you. We're closing in on the final questions now. Let me try to get a couple of quick takes. Let me begin with you, Mr. Brown. What do you think of the job that President Obama is doing, and would you like to have him come to California and campaign at your side?
Yes, he's coming to campaign for me, and I'm very happy with that. I think in a tough time, this man has created a stimulus. He helped stabilize our banks. We've got a health care plan that people since Harry Truman have been trying to get enacted, not perfect, got a lot of work on it. I think he's facing tremendous and unreasoned opposition by a small faction of that Republican people in Washington. So I think Obama's doing a good job.
Ms. Whitman? Ms. Whitman, a real force in your party is Sarah Palin. She'll be in California on Saturday. She's been the governor of a big Western state. Are you going to seek her advice on what you may do for California after her experience in Alaska?
So Sarah Palin's coming to California, and she's doing fundraising and a number of other things. And you know what? She has a real following in the Republican Party, but you know that I have actually supported other presidential nominees in our party, whether it was John McCain or my long-term friend Mitt Romney. So that day, I'm going to be out with voters talking about the things that matter to Californians, and that is jobs. I promise you, if we don't cut taxes, if we don't streamline regulation, there's no way we're ever going to get out of this financial mess. As I said, you know what jobs do? Think about a family for a minute. What a job does is put the family budget back together. What more jobs in California will do is put the California budget back together. And I just have to say one thing. The notion that Jerry Brown is going to be tough on unions is just a fairy tale. He's been joined at the hip with them for 40 years.
You've just run over, your time, and we're getting to a very quick close. We have about 2 minutes left. I want to get from each of you the question that I think is central to California. In the 21st century, does California have to reform its fundamental political structure, referendum, term limits, two-thirds vote on any budget? Do you have to go back and build the state politically from the ground up? Very briefly, Ms. Whitman, if you'd begin, please.
So I think there is a way forward with some fundamental reforms. And the budget plan that I have is, first, to increase tax revenues by more companies, more jobs being in California. We've got to get our hands around government spending. We spend more money than we can take in. It's not sustainable. But there are three reforms I would be very interested in pursuing. First is a two-year budgeting process. The one-year budgeting process doesn't work for us anymore because it doesn't allow you to make the investments that you need. It doesn't allow you to have a long-term perspective. I think we need to.
It said yellow. You're at the red light.
Okay.
Mr. Brown's turn. We have less than a minute, Jerry.
All right. Look, I'm going to take the world as I find it if I become the next governor, and we've got to wrestle this budget to the ground under the existing rules. But I hope we get a majority vote for the budget, not for taxes. And another part of my proposal for fixing this budget mess is a pay-as-you-go requirement. Anytime you propose a bill, tell us how you're going to fund it. That's very important. And I want to say something about unions and businesses. They're all influencers. They're all interest groups. They're all part of the democratic process. I've been in the kitchen. I've taken the heat. I know what it is to say yes and what it is to say no. She's been in the bleachers looking from the internet company at what's happening in government. I've been in this government. I love California. Okay. I know how it works, and I've got the intestinal fortitude to do what is right for California.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Jerry Brown, Attorney General, Meg Whitman, the CEO of eBay. This has been a very instructive evening. We hope you've enjoyed it. Thanks to Dominican College and everyone here. Thank you all very much.
And that concludes this debate between Attorney General Jerry Brown and former eBay CEO Meg Whitman, the Democratic and Republican candidates for governor of California. This was their third and final debate before the November 2nd election, a lively exchange on a wide range of issues. I'm Scott Schaefer, and you're listening to a special statewide broadcast of the California Report.